This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's episode. It features an interview with Miko Peled that first aired November 26, 2021. In it, the author and activist discusses growing up in a staunchly Zionist family in Israel and how his views of Israel and the Palestinians changed over the years. But first, news. Representative Rashida Tlaib drew criticism from members of Congress and from Jonathan Greenblatt, the head of the Anti-Defamation League, for saying in a recent video address that, quote, "you cannot claim to be progressive yet back Israel's apartheid government," end quote, a statement her critics denounced as anti-Semitic, though the UN, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and other human rights groups in Israel and Palestine have issued lengthy studies concluding Israel is an apartheid state. Greenblatt accused Tlaib of doubling down on anti-Semitism by slandering Israel as such. Katie Halper, a journalist for The Hill, a political newspaper covering Congress, defended Tlaib, saying in a video commentary on The Rising, The Hill's popular morning talk show, that the only Palestinian-American member of Congress had simply spoken the truth. Halper's commentary was censored, and 3 days later, she was fired. The Middle East Monitor reported September 29th that according to Israeli news accounts, Israel has greenlighted the use of armed drones to carry out assassinations of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. The Jerusalem Post reported that the order comes as Israeli security forces have encountered a significant rise in shooting attacks and massive gunfire during arrest raids, specifically in the northern West Bank cities of Jenin and Nablus. The Israeli public broadcaster, Kan, called the new instructions an unprecedented escalation in the activity of the Israeli army. An independent audit found that Facebook restricted Palestinian posts during the two-week war in May 2021 between the militant group Hamas, which governs Gaza, and Israel. Hired by Meta, the parent company for Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, the outside consultant, Business for Social Responsibility, said that Facebook erroneously removed Palestinian posts during the war and that censorship fell more heavily on Arabic speakers than on Hebrew speakers. While the report only investigated the period around the 2021 war and its immediate aftermath, it speaks to years of complaints from Palestinian journalists and activists that Facebook and Instagram censor their posts more often than those of Hebrew speakers. My guest today is Miko Peled, a karate instructor, activist, author, and speaker. He served in the Israeli military and Israel Special Forces and recounts in his 2012 memoir, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, how his perceptions of Israel changed over the years, leading Miko Peled to become an advocate for Palestinian rights. Miko Peled lives in this country and writes and speaks frequently about Israel and Palestine. Miko Peled, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to begin by talking a little about your family background. You come from a prominent Zionist family with a kind of storied pedigree in Israel, grandson of one of the signers of Israel's Declaration of Independence, a prominent figure during the Mandate period, and the son of one of Israel's great generals. Your wife's great uncle was a president of Israel. Could you talk about the attitudes and political beliefs you grew up with? And how was it you came to question not only Israel's policies, but eventually Zionism itself?
It was a long process. That's why there's a book. But to make it short, I took a step into this journey, which is the subtitle of the book, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, a step from the side of the privileged, the occupiers, where we live with water running, taken for granted, electricity taken for granted, great roads, beautiful homes, safety, and so on, to the side where Palestinians live, where there's no safety guaranteed for them, where the roads are full of potholes, there is no regular water supply, there is no regular electricity. They live in an entirely different reality, and we live across the street from each other, quite literally. And so I ventured from the one side to the other, which is really a step that very few people take. And what I found on the other side is that the people who live there are not terrorists. They're not violent. They're not hateful Arabs, as I was taught to believe, and as many Israelis are taught to believe, but people, just people. And I couldn't understand, I couldn't justify why it was that on my side of the road, life is so clean and privileged, and on the other side, it isn't. I mean, why can't everybody enjoy the same privileges? I just couldn't live with that. And so that was the first step into this realization. And then that led me, of course, to change my views on the politics and the reality and what should be the reality in that country, in Palestine, which I call Palestine, by the way.
In 1997, your 13-year-old niece was murdered in a Palestinian suicide bombing. Could you talk about that tragic event and the impact of it on you and your family?
Words can't really do justice to the type of tragedy that is when a little girl is killed like that. It changes your life completely. And that's precisely the kind of shock, kind of experience that forces you to reevaluate everything you believe in and to re-examine everything you think you know. And that's precisely the process that took place. That's precisely the process that led me to take that step across the street into where the Palestinians live and to get an understanding of, you know, how is it that two young or three actually young men decide to kill themselves in such a violent way and then kill other people? I mean, it's such a horrifying thing to think about. And that was really what led me into this self-reflection. And then that's what led me to reach the conclusions that I reached eventually.
You joined the Israeli military as a young man, the Israeli Special Forces. My impression is that you became disillusioned with the Israeli military fairly early on. Is that correct? And why?
Well, it is correct. I mean, in Israel, the military service is mandatory. In those days, refusing was not really something people did, although looking back, I wish I had refused. But yes, I joined willingly and happily, just like most Israelis tend to do. This is 1980. Within the first year, I realized that what the Israeli army was doing had nothing to do with defending the state of Israel. It had everything to do with making a life hell for the Palestinians. And then a year later, Israel's invasion of Lebanon began, and that was to lead to a 20-year occupation of southern Lebanon, countless casualties, horrible killings of Palestinians and Lebanese civilians. Those were definitely years in which I realized that the glory that I was led to believe was part of the Israeli military is really just part of the myth. It's part of the entire myth of the state of Israel and the myth of the glory of Zionism and so forth. It's an occupation army. It's an oppression army. It's a violent army. It's an army that has no moral standards whatsoever. And yes, I became completely disillusioned.
I know you became a karate expert. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because that's really quite interesting to me. Why karate? And why have you come to feel that karate supports your quest for peace?
I started karate when I was in high school as an activity that I decided to join to start up with friends. And then I fell in love with it. During the military service, obviously, I had to stop. And then when I was discharged, I went right back to it and made it into my career. I mean, karate in its purest form, which is really the way I studied it, not as a sport, not as competition, but in a very pure form, is all about pacifism. It's all about how not to use the skills that you have, but coming to that realization through the perfection of skills, of fighting skills, which in a way sounds contradictory, but that's the depth of it. And it's a great tool to teach children how to resolve problems, how to develop the kind of confidence you need in order to not get into fights. Because when children get into fights, when they become violent, it's usually because of a lack of confidence and a lack of self-esteem. And then for adults, it's the same thing. It's a wonderful path to take. It's a lifelong path. It teaches respect in a very, very deep way. In a very profound way, it provides self-esteem, which many adults, if not most, are in serious need of developing, and the kind of confidence that allows us to do better in whatever endeavor we choose to undertake. But really, the depth of karate in its purest form, of all martial arts, really are profound. And to make take a leap from there to the 2021 Olympics in Tokyo, where probably one of the bravest stances that was taken was by an Algerian judo practitioner who refused to compete against a member of the Israeli team. can only imagine how hard he had to work to get to the Olympics. And it cost him the Olympics because he was kicked out. And then it cost him the International Judo Federation kicked him out, and he's banned from practicing, from competing for 10 years. So he paid a heavy price, but that's precisely how you win. In other words, he defeated his Israeli opponents didn't even have to step on the mat to do that. He defeated them by taking a stance, a righteous moral stance, refusing to legitimize, refusing to recognize the flag and the state that these other athletes were representing. So there's a deep connection here.
Well, I'm interested that you say it teaches respect. Do you mean respect for yourself, respect for your opponent? Tell me more about what you mean by respect.
Well, all of the above. I mean, respecting somebody when there's no challenge is easy. Respecting somebody when there is a challenge, when there is a reason not to respect them, is hard. And to maintain respect throughout for yourself, of course, primarily, because if you don't respect yourself, nothing matters. If we don't have self-respect, then that's when everything goes to hell. But developing a sense of respect, of understanding of ourselves, our physical abilities, our limitations, both physical and mental and emotional, and also respecting other people for who they are, for what they are, for what it is that they bring to the table, good and bad. And if need be, respecting them as opponents so that we have a better understanding of what it is that we're facing, whether it's, you know, it doesn't have to be, of course, it doesn't have to be physical. It could be an opponent in any other capacity.
You seem to have grown disenchanted with the Israeli military and even Israeli society when still a young man, but pro-Palestinian activism did not swiftly or naturally follow. In your book, you talk about how in 2000, you began participating in dialogues between Palestinians and Jews in San Diego. And you mentioned that you and your wife felt a lot of fear about this. What were your fears?
You know, if you had asked me that question as I was planning to embark on this journey, I would have said, I have no fears. Why would I fear anybody or anything? As I began the actual physical journey, even here with the United States, even in San Diego, you know, my first trip to visit a Palestinian at his home for the very first meeting of this dialogue group, I was terrified. I mean, I've never been to a Palestinian home. I've never been with Palestinians. And fear is something that is injected to us a little bit like a virus. We're not fully aware of it until suddenly something happens and it hits us. So I didn't think I was afraid. And the same thing happened when I was driving in Palestine. First time I drove into the West Bank by myself to meet people in the West Bank, Palestinians in the West Bank. As I started the trip, I was fine. As I got closer, as I got into the West Bank, as I started driving along these potholed roads and seeing that everybody around me was a Palestinian and all the signs were in Arabic, and suddenly I'm in this other world, literally the world of the other. That's when the fear suddenly, it's not a panic attack, but it's definitely some sort of an attack. It's like this fear virus suddenly becomes active. It's very challenging. You have to decide if you're going to succumb to it, turn around and go back to safety, or if you're going to just continue on that path and overcome that fear in whatever way you can. And that was the choice that I made. But I didn't think I was afraid, and then realized as I was in it that everything I was taught my entire life was not to do what I was actually embarking on, not to take that trip, not to take that journey, not to travel into the West Bank without a weapon, not to go and meet people that I don't know, not to venture into that other side. Everything I was taught and everything that was put into me, whether it was obvious or not obvious, suddenly came up. And I realized just how deep the fear was, what a challenge it presented in trying to overcome it.
Do you think that fear is deliberately manufactured by the Israeli government? Or is it something that everyone throughout Israeli society feels themselves?
Well, everybody feels it because it's manufactured. I mean, the entire justification for the existence of the state, which is, they call it a Jewish state. It's not, there's nothing Jewish about it. It's a racist, violent state that has taken over a country that did no wrong to anyone, which is Palestine, and is killing its people for absolutely no reason. So the only way to justify the violence, the racism, the brutality is through fear. How else would you convince a young person to volunteer, to carry a gun, to go into villages and, you know, blow up homes, to arrest children and intimidate them and beat them and kill them? Fear is the justification. Fear of the other is precisely what is the tool that is used in order to justify these actions. And by the way, Israel didn't invent anything new. I mean, other countries do this, other people do this. Why were Americans willing to go to Iraq and Afghanistan? Because somebody told them we had to fear these people, they were coming to get us. Manufacturing this fear is a very successful industry, and that's precisely what the State of Israel has perfected.
If you're just joining us, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margo Patterson, and I'm talking to Miko Peled, an author and activist who grew up in Israel. Miko, we've used the word Zionism in our conversation, and I think some Americans are unsure about what Zionism really means or is. Could you talk about what Zionism is?
Sure. Zionism is, in a sentence, it's an ideology that claims that all Jewish people have a right to live in Palestine at the expense of Palestinians. That's in a sentence. It was an ideology that actually began with Christian Protestantism in the 19th century, in the mid-19th century, or even before that, actually, when Christians developed this notion that the Jews need to return to their ancient homeland in order for the second coming to arrive and stuff like that, that sort of thing. Secular Jews towards the very end of the 19th century and more so beginning of the 20th century took this ideology and turned it into a national movement that said all Jewish people are part of a nation, as opposed to what they really are, which is a religion or religious groups that lives among other nations. So you could be a Polish Jew, a Russian Jew, an American Jew, Iraqi Jew, whatever. So the Zionists said, no, all Jews are part of the same nation. They share a history, which is the Bible. And again, that was borrowed from Christianity, saying that the Bible somehow is to be read literally and is a history book. That Palestine is the homeland of the Jewish people, which is, of course, not true, because for thousands of years, Jews lived in other countries. Almost the entire body of Judaism was developed outside while Jews were living in other countries over the past couple thousand years. And then, so they had a so-called history book, they had a so-called country, and they basically created this national movement that said all Jews need to get up and go back, so to speak, to their ancient homeland. In the beginning, Jews thought they were crazy. I mean, this whole idea was crazy. Why would Jews leave their lives and the countries in which they live and go back there? And as early as 1900, the main rabbis throughout the world came out with a book which warned Jewish people about the dangers of Zionism, the dangers that this ideology presents, because they said it would bring violence to the Holy Land unnecessarily, which it did. It would ruin the good relations that Jewish people had who lived in the Arab world. You know, there were very good relations between Jews and Arabs and Jews and Muslims in general, because they're the two sister religions. And it would cast doubt as to the loyalty of Jews in the countries in which they live. And we see this today. People ask, wait a minute, are you loyal to your country as an American, or are you loyal to Israel as a Jew? Whereas before that, this was not a question. If you were an American, you were an American, and you happen to be Jewish. So this shows us how deeply concerned Jews were as Zionism developed. And of course, exactly what they prophesied, exactly what they expected happened. And it's not because they were prophets, it's because that they had eyes and ears and they were intelligent people. So that's what Zionism is. And of course, over the 20th century, it developed a lot of steam and it got support from mostly the British. And then later on, it got a lot of support here in the United States. And here we are today, where you have the State of Israel, which is really founded upon this ideology that says that Jewish people have a right to a country that belongs to somebody else, which is Palestine, based on this idea that the ancient mythology of the Old Testament is an actual history, and the Jewish people are not just a religion, but are an actual nation like other nations.
I want to ask you a little bit about your father and his own life journey. It seems to me you've been on a remarkable journey, but he went on one too. He fought in the 1947-49 war and then became a general in the Six-Day War. He later became a critic of that war and condemned Israel for seizing and not returning the West Bank, Sinai, and Golan Heights, and called the world war a cynical campaign of territorial expansion. He was prescient about how the occupation would affect Israel and the Palestinians both. He became an Arabist and founded the Arabic Literature Department at Tel Aviv University, and he started an unofficial dialogue with the Palestine Liberation Organization. In your book, I had the impression that growing up, you tremendously admired and respected your father, but that your relationship was somewhat distant. I'm wondering, as you followed your own path, if that relationship has somehow grown closer. I know he's dead, but I think we all have relations with our parents that continue even after they die. And I wonder if your understanding of him has changed as you've grown older and followed your own very unique path.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, everything you said up to this point is absolutely true. But in terms of the actual relationship, I was not engaged in any of this work while he was still alive. I began this after he passed away. He passed away in 1995. I didn't really start engaging in this until around the year 2000 or 1999. And so I never had the conversation with him. But what I did find is that I have less and less tolerance for people who accept what he did in his early days or see it as acceptable. He was deeply engaged. He was an officer in the campaign of 1947 to 1949, like you said, which was a vicious campaign of ethnic cleansing, cruel campaign that included countless massacres, included death marches. People were, you know, forced to march in the streets in the heat of summer with people dying of thirst. I mean, it was a horrible, horrible, cruel campaign, which basically had to be done to get rid of the population and take their homes and take their land. That's what had to be done to create the state of Israel. And then he remained an officer and had a military career. And again, in a military that had the belief that they need to always be the cruelest, most brutal force in the region, in the neighborhood, so to speak. And then, of course, he was a general. And then he was one of the leaders of the 1967 war, one of the military leaders. As a general, Israel supported, while he was in the military, Israel supported the vicious regime of Mobutu in the Congo after the U.S. had organized to assassinate the elected leader of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba. He was involved in supporting the army of the Shah of Iran, who, as we know, was a brutal dictator, and other countries that Israel and the Israeli military had supported and trained. And I just look back and I think, how can somebody do this? How can you be willingly involved in, first of all, in this brutality in Palestine towards Palestinians, and then also supporting brutal dictators elsewhere? Immediately after the 67 war, he retired. He chose to go to retirement a year later. He stood up and he said, well, now we have an opportunity to solidify our accomplishments by allowing the Palestinians their own state on a small part of Palestine, and then making peace with all of our neighbors. And this was from the perspective of somebody who wanted to make sure that the state of Israel was solid, was strong, and was able to live in peace with its neighbors. And to that end, he began to promote this idea of a two-state solution, which called for a Palestinian state in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And he had this old little group, which eventually, like you said, met with unofficially with leaders within the PLO, which in those days was unheard of. Eventually, they met with Yasser Arafat. But really, it led to a second catastrophe for the Palestinians, because Palestinians lowered their guard. The Palestinians completely eliminated any form of resistance to Israel. They accepted and recognized the state of Israel. And things only got worse and worse and worse for them. As we see today, things have never been worse. And to a large degree, that is the result of the fact that the Palestinian leadership was willing to listen and speak and meet with my father and others, and eventually recognize and try to make peace with the state of Israel, where you should not do. You should never try to make peace with your oppressor. You need to, we're talking about following an example. Nelson Mandela had the same option. He chose to stay in jail until apartheid collapsed completely, and people of color, Black Africans, were allowed complete political freedom. So in many ways, you know, people say, oh, he had a journey. He was a man of peace. He was a man with a very strong belief about the state of Israel and the righteousness of the state of Israel and the righteousness of Zionism, which to me is really unforgivable. He was my father, of course, and that's, you know, that's the way it is. But in terms of his work, in terms of his ideology, perhaps he thought he was doing the right thing. I mean, he did help many Palestinians who were in need once he was in a position to help. As a former general, he would help get Palestinians out of jail or help, you know, prevent Palestinians from being deported and that sort of thing. But by and large, he supported in a very big way this enterprise, which I find appalling. So yeah, I guess the relationship doesn't end when our parents die.
You're very outspoken in favoring a one-state solution that would give equal rights to Jews and Palestinians living in one democratic state, despite all the settlers and settlements in the West Bank, which seem to be increasing exponentially. there still seems many Americans who cling to the idea of a two-state solution. I have the impression that you advocate for a single binational state, not only because you think Israel has made a two-state solution impossible by colonizing the West Bank so extensively, but because you think a one binational state solution is better. Why?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, to begin with, Israel made any other option impossible. Israel created a single state over all of Palestine. So there is a single state over Palestine, which gives preferential treatment and privilege to Israeli Jews and treats Palestinians as worse than second-class citizens. The Palestinians basically live without rights. I believe in human rights. I believe that all people should have the same rights, should enjoy the same privileges. And I can't accept that kind of a regime anywhere, certainly not in Palestine. I also think that whether you're the jailer or you're the prisoner, you live in a jail, you live in a prison. And so Israelis live in a prison, even though they happen to be the jailers and they have they have freedom, they are still the jailers. And that's a very negative way to live. It's very violent. It's very oppressive. And I think it's not healthy for anyone. I think Israelis will do very well, will be much happier when they can live among free people in a free, open Palestine, in a free, open society with a real democracy, with a one person, one vote, without this massive spending on military, without this militarized society, which, by the way, the rates of youth violence, the rates of spousal abuse and so forth are huge, are off the charts in Israeli society. The discourse is violent and racist. That's not good for anyone. It's not good for the jailer either. I wouldn't want my kids to grow up like that, certainly. So I think growing up in a jail, whether the jailer or the prisoner, is unhealthy. And growing up in a free society is better for everyone. Israelis are completely unaware of the enormous contributions that Palestinians had made in history, throughout history, and continue to make even under these very, very grim conditions, and have the potential to make as co-countrymen.
Final sure. question. This country, the United States, is very involved in the struggle between Israel and the Palestinians. What would you like Americans to know about the U.S. role in that struggle? And how would you like them to change U.S. policy?
Well, I'd like every single American to make sure that elected officials, whether they run for school board, city council, mayor, sheriff, state legislatures, and of course, national office, must understand that associating with Israel and associating with Zionism is associating with racism. It's associating with apartheid. That we must demand from elected officials to distance themselves from Israel, distance themselves from Zionism, or else they will not get your vote. We have to make it absolutely clear that sanctions against the state of Israel must be a priority. Must be a priority. Israel must not be permitted to participate in the Olympics, in other sporting events, in cultural events, in academic events. The state of Israel must be brought to a place that South Africa, apartheid South Africa was, and that's what led to the fall of apartheid. That is what I would ask every single person who votes to make sure that they sit their representatives down and demand of them that not a single dollar, not a single bullet, not a single warplane is ever to the state of Israel again. And that America stand behind the creation of a real democracy with equal rights in Palestine.
Mikko Pellad, thank you so much for talking to us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine. The views expressed in the program are those of the guests and host and do not reflect those of the radio station or anyone associated with it. Join us again next week for another episode of Understanding Israel-Palestine.